Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. Limerick, the 2014 City of Culture, hit the news last weekend when personality clashes, quarrelling and ultimately a number of high-profile resignations characterised the first week of the year. On the airwaves last weekend, we heard much about the meeting of approximately 500 people which took place on a wet and windy night in Limerick's Clarion Hotel last Friday. Have a listen to what happened when the meeting organisers attempted to ban members of the media from attending that meeting.
Thank you for coming out on such an appalling night to what I believe to be a very important meeting for our city. If I could at this point ask if there are any media present in the building, present in the meeting, I think as a point of courtesy to all of us, I would ask them, would they mind leaving?
No, 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 absolutely not.
Okay. Yes, can I have, sorry. Yes, okay. I'm just going to ask the question. Because what will happen is you may say something. No, no.
Honestly, the media needs to be here. Yes. They're behind the ears of the people.
Okay. Can I have a show of hands around whether the media should be here or not?
Here.
Okay, it's unanimous. I'm sorry. This is a public meeting.
I'm sorry.
Okay, for assuming something. Thank you. I'm sorry.
A recording from Friday night's meeting in Limerick, as heard in Brian O'Connell's report on Monday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. Much of Saturday with Claire Byrne was devoted to analysis of the fallout from Friday's meeting, and board member Tim O'Connor told Claire and her panel about some of the commitments which were made at that meeting.
We made two commitments last night. The chairman, Pat Cox, made two commitments. We're going to advertise now in very short order for expressions of interest for the post of artistic director, and we're going to appoint a number of additional people onto the board, including representatives from the arts community in Limerick, and that was a commitment last night.
Perhaps that should have been done from the get-go.
I said, Claire, we have lessons to learn, and we're absorbing them rapidly. Limerick is it's a proud place. We're also the home of Munster Rugby, although we didn't have a great night last night. Munster Rugby, we know that as they've often proved, you know, games are not won in the first few minutes; they're won in the last minute. So we've a long road ahead of us. We're determined it's going to be a tremendous year.
Journalist Pat Leahy was also a guest on Saturday with Claire Byrne, and he also gave his own take on Tim O'Connor's rugby analogy.
What an awful pity for Limerick that the people in charge of this thing have made such a bags of it. Tim mentioned earlier on that rugby matches are not won in the first 10 minutes. No, they tend to be won, as Tim will know, in the months beforehand when teams train and prepare for this. This was announced in the summer of 2012. Yes, yet it wasn't until a couple of months ago that the project got an allocation in the budget. Now, if Jimmy Dinahan was, prepared to make the announcement of this in 2012, how come he couldn't secure a budget allocation a couple of months later in the budget at the end of 2012, which would have enabled the sort of preparations which clearly needed to be going on all last year?
Pat Leahy has heard on Saturday with Claire Byrne. On Sunday's Marion Finucane show, we heard from the editor of the Limerick Leader, Alan English, who gave a local perspective on the controversy.
Well, I was at the meeting on Friday night, which was probably one of the most journalistically memorable events I've covered in years. It was about 500 people packed into the Clarion Hotel on the river, and there were a lot of hysterical talk. There was a lot of people who made a lot of sense as well, though. I mean, I felt there were enough of people in that room, and what it showed as well, it was an enormous turnout. It was a horrendous night in Limerick, but at least 500 people made their way to the Clarion Hotel because it was a demonstration that there is a huge cultural sector in Limerick, people who are passionate to make Limerick a success in the City of Culture year.
Yeah.
There were enough of voices in that room, in my opinion, and I heard some very notable contributions, and I believe that there were people in that room who could be brought on board in an advisory capacity, in a mediation capacity. I absolutely feel that there was a will within the room to get over the issues and to drive on.
Limerick leader, editor Alan English on the Marion Finucane show on Sunday. Later that day, Arts Minister Jimmy Deanahan spoke to Colm O'Mungon on This Week. And at this point in the interview, Colm asks the minister about how exactly Carl Wallace came to resign as artistic director of the festival.
Given that there is €6 million of scarce resources going into the Limerick City of Culture, why didn't you call him and try and get to the bottom of it? He had been in place, after all, since the early part of this year. And then with a falling out with the chief executive, who'd only been in place since the autumn, all of a sudden Carl Wallace is gone, and with him perhaps some of the chances of some of the things he had lined up for the City of Culture. Did you not lift the phone and ask him, Carl, what's going on?
Well, he had announced it before I knew he was going to resign. I wasn't aware of his resignation. So obviously, if I was aware that he was threatening to resign or something, if he had concerns, I would have discussed it with him. But I just read about his resignation in the paper. So he had resigned at that stage. So obviously, there was no point in having a discussion with him. He had made up his mind.
But surely that's almost more concerning, that on the 21st he's still on board, the minister in charge of the arts department, which has provided the funding to the City of Culture, is unaware that there's any difficulty, and then 9 days later, bang, Carl Wallace is gone.
Well, these are issues that I will be raising next week with the board and with the City Council, with the manager. These are issues, obviously, I will be raising with him. And if I do get an opportunity to speak to Carl Wallace, I'll certainly listen to him as well.
Later in the interview, Colm O'Mungon also asked the minister about the role he played in overseeing the festival.
But Minister, you're talking about reading things in the papers, about hearing things at arm's length, about being as much in the dark as other members of the public. You're the Minister for Arts. You gave
course,
them the
yeah.
money. Who's looking after the taxpayers' interests here and making sure that this money is spent on what it's supposed to be spent on?
Yeah, well, I suppose they received no money, yes. So, obviously, this discussion will ensure that all the money that will be spent in Limerick will have to be very, very clearly accounted for. And as regards what appeared in the paper, this all happened just 4 days ago. And this is the holiday period. Obviously, I was in contact with people. I've been in contact with the city manager in order to meet him next week. I've been in contact with Pat Cox in order to meet the board next week. So it's not that I haven't been doing anything, and I'm more concerned about this than anyone, because it was I who, I suppose, initiated this programme, and I want to make sure it will work.
From last Sunday's This Week, following another resignation later that day, that of the festival's chief executive, Patricia Ryan. By lunchtime on Tuesday, Mike Fitzpatrick, a new interim head of the festival, had been appointed. On Tuesday's News at 1, festival chairman Pat Cox told Jonathan Clinch about that appointment and how he and the rest of the board had reacted to criticism and calls for their resignation.
I have to accept that when there was a crisis of this sort, of course, the first place, the first role of the board is to hear the criticism and to accept and respond to it. But a board is also the last line of defence. And the truth is that if I or the board resigned, the City of Culture would have had no executives and no board with the responsibility to work through the crisis. Quitting would have been the wrong thing. It would have been an easy thing, but would have produced no result.
Pat Cox on Tuesday's News at 1. Although there were a lot of negatives in the Limerick City of Culture story, one positive aspect which did emerge and which we heard mentioned on several occasions throughout the week was the pride and passion of the people of Limerick. On Monday's Liveline, we heard more about that spirit when Suzanne rang in with her story about how her house was destroyed by a fire on Christmas Eve. Unfortunately, due to her current economic circumstances, Suzanne let her house insurance lapse just weeks before the fire. Although she and her family have been left effectively homeless as a result of the fire, the support of friends, family and members of the wider community in Limerick have helped her to get through the ordeal. Here, Suzanne describes how she came home to find her house on fire.
At 6 o'clock, Christmas Eve, I came home. I came around the corner and my husband had been with his sister, with my daughter, and I thought he had come home to put on the fire because I could see the smoke coming out the chimney. The blinds were closed, the lights were off. When I got, my son got to the door and my daughter both were with me. I thought I might have left the ham on or something because we could hear the smoke alarms going off. And my son went in, and looking now how dangerous that was, you know, in hindsight, I would have not left him in.
Yeah.
He went to the kitchen on his all fours with the smoke billowing everywhere. And into the kitchen, he could see that there was nothing on. And when he coming out, his room would have been to the right. He could see the smoke and the fire in his room. And at that moment, he went out towards the hall, and the window from the backdraft busted out. And either it would have went through the window or out the other direction, and he would have been killed. I'm still in awe of the whole thing. Yeah. It's like, you know, you build your house up to be your castle. I never drank, never smoked, and I tried to put my home around me. And, you know, to be left with nothing. All our possessions gone. Nothing left, only the clothes on our back.
Suzanne, a caller to Liveline on Monday. The devastation caused by the weather was another big story on air this week. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Aisling Kenny visited the coastal community of Quilty, County Clare, where she first visited the home of John and Leslie O'Connor.
My kids are distraught. The big thing about it is their two little pit dogs drowned, you know, and Caitlin was upstairs and she heard the cry of the pups and she said, "Mammy, there's something wrong," she said, "with those little with our pups." And we sooner found out, you know, that the pups had died. They had drowned. They found one that particular day, and 3 days later the other one was found. When I looked out that morning and at the sliding door, and it was up to the level of the handle of the door, I went to the front of the house, was at the windowsills. I got very claustrophobic in myself, thinking, "Oh my God, are we going to survive this? What's going to happen next? Like, is the sea going to..." I could just see the waves kind of hitting, and I just had to be strong for my kids. And it's just devastating, you know. I haven't slept now in 3 nights.
John says he's very concerned about how they'll pay for the damage, as their insurance cover isn't enough.
Not near enough cover. I sent an insurance rep. He reckons I won't have enough cover in it. I had the house covered for the minimum, the contents, the minimum. Do you know, at the time, we didn't think house prices were gone down, and never thought anything like this was going to happen.
Andy Clancy, who's a farmer in the area, was feeding his cattle on Friday morning when the sea began to come inland.
10 foot of sand there where we're looking at, and the next thing, it was all gone. Just Friday morning, and it just went about, it came in there about, 100 feet of sand. It was just gone out to sea. So there's about two and a half acres.
And how did you feel when that happened?
Just frightening. I couldn't believe it. I thought I wouldn't see it in my time. Like, it's just terrible to look around there. There's houses underwater. It's just frightening. There's a house over there, and I'll show it to you. And the waves was hitting the corner of the house. They have to put on some rock armour or something here to stop the sea coming in. Because the next thing it's going to be out in the main road.
Yeah. Do you want a cup of tea, love?
Yes, please.
Okay.
82-year-old Martin Clancy has lived in Quilty all his life. He says the last time the area was flooded so badly was 22 years ago.
22 years, as I was telling you about the first flood, I was out of my tractor bringing people here and there. That's the time it should have been done. Because that time, they could build a wall, no problem whatsoever, that time, a good wall, because the land was there. There's a lot more work to do now. I don't like it, to be honest with you. I don't like it. I don't. I wish to God now I could sell the place. Terrible, really terrible it is.
From Aisling Kenny's report on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. On Monday's Morning Ireland, the CEO of the rehab group, Angela Cairns, spoke to Gavin Jennings about work the group is doing with people with disabilities in Saudi Arabia. Towards the end of the interview, Gavin asked her about another subject which has been in the news in recent weeks.
There's been much discussion recently about the way charities here, especially charities like yours that receive state funding, pay their senior staff. Your most recently reported salary was €234,000 a year, considerably more than recommended by the HSC and considerably more than the Taoiseach. Is that still your salary, Angela Cairns?
Sure. Can I just comment on this, Gavin? First and foremost, the rehab group is not similar to most of the other charities. Over 60% of our activities is in the commercial area. And we do have a number of companies within the rehab group that work with the Irish government and the HSE. We're not, and even that's rehab care part of our organisation, and that is not even in the Section 38 arena. But can I just say, the people want to see fair and appropriate remuneration. And the best way to achieve this is by independent professional evaluation on the role based on the size and the responsibility of the organisation.
Okay.
And there are many experts out there, Gavin, just to say, like Hayes and Towers Watson, and they do this professionally. And I believe the public would want this done. But I would also say to you that there's an awful lot of private companies that do business with the state. And in fact, we find ourselves tendering against those private companies. And they too should be declaring in the exact same way, and they should be treated in the same way as the not-for-profit.
But rehab gets around
all taxpayers' money.
It is. Rehab gets around 50 million euro a year in state funding and millions more from public donations. Are taxpayers and donors not entitled to know where their money is going? Is 234,000 euro a year still your salary?
Can I just say, first and foremost, within the rehab group, as I say, 40% of our activities is in the not-for-profit sector and 60% is in the commercial. And we're in Ireland, Poland, the Netherlands, Scotland, England, Wales, and now in Saudi Arabia. So we are actually, I suppose, an organisation of social values, but commercially underpinned. And the most important thing is that the remunerations of all senior staff are independently done by professional people who know what they're doing and can evaluate it properly. So I don't wish to comment on anybody's salary other than say that that should be done and it should be transparent.
So you're not willing to let us know what your current salary is?
I have declared my salary on a number of occasions, Gavin, already.
It's not. I'm looking at your website and I can't see it. So I'm only going by the most recently reported salary of 234,000 euro a year.
I appreciate that, and people may have a view, but I still go back. The most important thing for salaries of senior staff is that they're properly and professionally evaluated.
Rehab Group CEO Angela Cairns talking to Gavin Jennings on Monday. Shannon Airport was in the news this week when the niece of fashion designer Ralph Lauren was arrested by Gardaí and charged with a number of air rage incidents. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Clare FM reporter John Cook told Mary Wilson about the events which unfolded on board the Delta flight from Barcelona to New York, as was heard in Ennis District Court earlier that day.
About 2 hours into the flight, she came to the attention of cabin crew. They noticed she was crying and holding her head against the wall beside her. She said there was an issue with her seat. It would not recline, and she seemed to be upset about the fact that the seat reclining mechanism wasn't working. Well, an air hostess, Constance Topping, went to her assistance and tried to help her, but she told the air hostess to get the F out of my face, and Tom Kennedy said that was a flavour of the attitude that was to follow, and to get worse. When the member of cabin crew asked her to calm down, her behaviour continued to deteriorate, and we were told her language did too, even though there were children nearby. The cabin crew member went to inform her supervisor, and as she looked down the aircraft, she saw Jenny Lauren coming up at speed, ranting and raving, shouting incoherently and telling them, "I'm going to go ballistic." And then she pushed the hostess, Miss Topping, hard against a wall. The air hostess said she was very frightened by the experience, and then she began to call her and her supervisor names and obscenities. She called them fat, ugly, blondes, and various other obscenities that I probably won't share with your listeners this evening, Mary. At this stage, other passengers became concerned and stood up. The captain was notified. Another pilot on board tried to intervene. He was called obscenities too. And at this point, they decided to divert to Shannon Airport on Monday.
We've heard of this sort of thing happening on aircraft before. Usually we're told it's a combination perhaps of prescription meds of some sort and alcohol. Did Jenny Lauren offer an explanation?
Yeah, there was an explanation offered. Her solicitor, Sharon Curley of Carmody & Company Solicitors in Shannon, said it wasn't an excuse but an explanation. She said that Miss Lauren had three drinks prior to the flight, it has to be said. They weren't consumed on the flight, and Judge Patrick Durkin questioned whether authorities in Barcelona should face questions over how this woman got on an airline. We heard she had a lot of medication with her and doesn't remember what happened on the flight. The alcohol had been consumed prior to the flight. She takes medication for a number of conditions, And in a letter supplied from a New York-based doctor, we learned about what was described as Jenny Lauren's difficult medical past. She suffers from depression. She overcame anorexia previously, and she's written extensively about eating disorders and won awards for her campaign work in this regard. She also suffers with bipolar disorder and a general anxiety disorder. And we're told this behaviour was simply bizarre and out of character. She was upset over Christmas. She was thinking of her mother who died in 2008, we were told. All of these things combined, but particularly we were told that the drink and the medication seemed to combine to create a situation that we were told quickly got out of control, left her disorientated and confused. And when she landed in Shannon Airport, she later told Gardaí that she thought she was in Spain.
Reporter John Cook, as heard on Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, on Today with Sean O'Rourke, we heard another story about another unhappy air passenger. On this occasion, however, journalist Mary Kenny was impeccably behaved, but slightly aggrieved at the treatment she received going through security at Gatwick Airport.
I was coming through the security barrier, you know, and I always say to the people at security, look, I've got hip replacements, so I will ring when I go through. I usually fly through Gatwick, and it's fine, it's grand, and they put the sensor around me. And but yesterday, when I told the young lady, I'm going to ring, and she... didn't, I think, believe me quite. I think she thought I was... anyway, she said she just didn't take my word for it. And she and a colleague took me away and asked me to show me, to show them my scars. I might have annoyed her by when we came through first and there were a few men in front of me and the men were addressed as sir, and she turned to me and she said, well, now, my darling, I'll deal with you. And I said, look, you call the guy sir, why do you call me my darling? Because I think it's a bit patronising, this habit of addressing women, and particularly older women, as my darling and dearie. And I may have annoyed her, and I think it's possible that she decided to sort of humiliate me by doing a strip search.
Well, how did this process begin when it was clear that you weren't going to go through without the signal going off?
Well, I always say that there will be a signal, because these bilateral hip replacements, one of them is steel, I think the other is made of some other material, but I will always ring going through something like that. But it's never a problem at any airport. I explain and they do the body search, you know, as they do in public. But this one was just a particularly rather aggressive attitude of, you know, show me your scars, we don't really believe you. I mean, and I was treated as though I was kind of an Al-Qaeda suspect or something.
That's how they made you feel. What exactly happened, though, Mary?
Well, you're taken away to a little curtained-off area, and I took off my dress, and then I had to take down my knickers and tights and show the scars. But having examined the scars, they then dismissed me in a rather austere way.
Journalist Mary Kenny on Wednesday's Today with Sean O'Rourke on the treatment she received at Gatwick Airport and why she and most women would really rather not be addressed by random strangers as darling. Kelly Mungan won the hearts of viewers of The Voice of Ireland last season, and she featured in a television documentary, What Kelly Did Next, on Thursday night. But on Wednesday, Mooney reporter Brenda Donoghue visited herself and her family in the caravan where she now lives in Galway. Brenda asked Kelly what it was like competing in last year's final when she was 9 months and 5 days pregnant.
A lot of pain in the back, but it was worth it. When the summer I wanted to be. I wanted to be on that stage. I wanted to be singing. And I prayed each week like the baby wouldn't come until the final was finished and the show was over and done with, you know. So thank God, like, God granted me that. And
how important is religion to you?
Oh, religion comes in a big way, I think, in all the Shannon community. A lot of communities it does, but it is, like, it's just believe in God. And I think the more you believe in God, the more you ask from God, the more you pray to God and Our Lady, the more they grant you, the more they give you, you know. So just have faith in them, like.
I love the sound of Bernie Jr. in the background there, smiling away. Is he your biggest achievement, would you say?
Oh, God, he is. Oh, Brendan, by 1,000 miles, he really is. Like, you know what I mean? He couldn't expect anything better than that, you know, God bless him. Like, the advice and everything went so well. It was all very good. And it was something I always wanted to do, but your baby is just, oh, it's just so much more. Like, you do it to make a living for him and to try and make things better for him, you know what I mean? So all this is for your family, to make things better for your children and stuff like that, so.
Kelly, what I'm trying to get at it is to do so well in The Voice and to be so popular. I nearly expected to be walking up to a big mansion today. Instead, it's a very small caravan, and I can see it's a struggle day to day to get on and to further your career. Is it a disappointment, really, is what I'm trying to get at?
It is a bit in a way, because like, you'd expect more after going out through all the hard work and everyone helping you out to get what you did, like what you achieved and stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, you'd expect a bit more. You'd like, you don't expect to be just left off afterwards and not getting a deal or a contract or something. Like, you know, I know I got my documentary and thank God for that. It's something that might build me up a bit more. But
what are your hopes for Bernie Jr. here? Would you like to see him go to school, go the whole way? Yeah.
I do, and I hope he do stay in school. I do, because like, even I left myself now third year, I did my junior cert, and I went to Uteridge. And thinking back now, like, I knew it's the hate school, oh, it's good to get out of it, but I'm sorry now that I didn't do my leaving cert and have it done, just to have it anyway, in case I ever need it tomorrow after. Do you know what I mean?
Kelly, is it difficult? Say you were born and bred in Fermoy and you had all the comforts of home there, and you're here in a caravan. Is it difficult to actually adapt, regardless of councils or not having a house or having a house, just on a personal level?
It is, like, we've no running water, we've no electricity, we've nothing. Like, we've went to the site and used the tiles and stuff inside there in the showers and there, or go out to his mother's and use out there because his mother's in a house and stuff. So it is very difficult. It's very, very hard, but you have to get used to it, like, it comes with life.
Kelly Mungan talking to Brenda Donoghue on Wednesday's Mooney. Also on Wednesday, the opening minutes of Liveline featured Louise McEntee, the mother of 4-year-old Liam, who has campaigned tirelessly, with a little help from Liveline, to bring Liam home from Our Lady's Hospital in Crumlin. On Wednesday, her dream came true and she spoke to Joe from the ambulance in which they were travelling, which was bringing Liam home to Galway for the first time ever.
We just left 10 minutes ago.
Great.
We're trying to settle Liam into the ambulance. He's very afraid of all. Tell him to shut up. He's very afraid of the ambulance sounds and everything. He's never been exposed to it before.
He's nearly 4, as we know, and he's never been in an ambulance before. But more importantly for the day that's in it, he's never been back to his hometown.
Yes, exactly.
And what time do you expect to be in Galway at?
We hope to be in Galway around 4:30, between 4 and 5:30.
And he's been taken to the university.
UCHG.
Yeah, the University Hospital in Galway.
Yes.
And how did... I know today he's the initial plan is to take him back to his hometown, to the hospital in his hometown, which is what you've been campaigning for. And
oh,
Our Ladies,
God.
The medics and the staff, all the staff and Our Ladies, they're happy for Liam that he's going back to his hometown.
They're very happy for him. They'll miss him terrible because they've worked up a lovely relationship between him and us. And they're going to miss him. There was a lot of tears now leaving Our Lady's Hospital there a little while ago, so we're just getting over that experience. But yeah,
I know
you're all happy to see him go.
Louise, how long? I know the first stage is to take him into the hospital near his home. And
yes.
What is the plan then?
The plan when we get back to Galway is for Liam to meet the nursing staff that Galway Hospital have recruited to look after Liam in the last couple of weeks. And that'll take a few weeks for all the nurses to come in on their shift work and get to meet him and know his cares.
Okay.
And then on daily visits, we'll be making daily visits out to Clonburn then.
To your
and
home. Brilliant, brilliant.
Hopefully by the end of the month, we'll be home. And that's a day we are so looking forward to. I don't know if anybody realises how hard it's been the last 3.5 years to finally come home to your area, and life will be so much easier for us. We're totally exhausted and depleted of energy and everything, but hopefully we'll start to regain a little bit of normality and a lovely time with Liam.
Louise McEntee, mother of 4-year-old Liam, as heard on Liveline on Wednesday. The woes of Manchester United manager David Moyes was another big story of the week. And on Tuesday's John Murray Show with Miriam, Paul McGrath gave his perspective on the story.
There must be such pressure on David Moyes. I mean, if you were in his shoes, Paul, what would you do now?
I'd take him off and I'd leave the club. I would never want that sort of pressure. And some men are built for the pressure. Sir Alex was one of those who, you know, anyone stepped out of line, you were basically, you were gone. Mm. I mean, it could happen once or twice, but you didn't get a third chance with Sir Alex. You were gone. And that's, it takes a hard man to do that, even if you're a good player or even if you're, you know, if you mess him about, he will mess you about and you'll be the loser.
Paul also spoke to Miriam about the high-profile spat he had with Sir Alex.
In my case, I was actually told not to speak to the press. I was given a ban on speaking to the press while stories were being written about me to the press, and it was Sir Alex's pals who were writing the stories. So, and I'd no comeback, so I had to take this for a few weeks just before I left the club, and I had no way of writing back because I was banned. I mean, so it was a strange situation.
So do you bear, not that you bear a grudge, but do you dislike Ferguson still because of what happened to you?
Not in the slightest, no. To be fair, I didn't speak to the man for 5 years after I left the club because I did love Manchester United. I genuinely did. It's a club that every player, I think, wants to play for. But at the same time, I just disliked the way, because I went in and asked for a higher wage, I just thought I've come of age and I won Player of the Year and stuff like that. And I was still on, you know, some of the reserves were getting the wages I was getting. So, you know, I just thought if you're ever going to be brave, you've got to be brave now and walk in and ask for a wage you think you're worth. And he said simply you should be happy to be wearing the red shirt. And so it all went off from there. So.
When you say you obviously didn't speak to him for 5 years, how did you end up speaking to him after 5 years?
Well, we actually beat Manchester United in the FA, at Wembley yeah. It was as well. And that was the first time he came up to me and he gave me a belt in the stomach, a little too hard. Luckily, I was tensed up. And he shook my hands and said, "Well done, son." And from that day to this, he's been nothing more than a gentleman to me.
Paul McGrath talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday. Paddy O'Gorman was out and about for the Today with Sean O'Rourke show on Monday when he went to meet some of those visiting loved ones in Mountjoy Prison. This woman told Paddy about how her son ended up in prison.
Drunk in a disorderly charge.
That's what it was.
Being drunk, giving the police the wrong name because he was afraid.
Do you think that prison does people any good or do you not? What do you think?
It all depends. It's up to the person themselves, actually. I was in prison for 5 years, being honest with you. I got a 5-year sentence off in England, and if I didn't get that sentence, I would have been dead. Right. Being honest with you, I would have been dead. I would have been 6 feet under, and it did me the world of good, and it really did. I did great. I've never gone back. I've never got arrested since then. I've never got a charge, so I've never been in trouble since then.
What prison in England was it?
I was in Holloway in England.
In North London.
Yeah, in North London.
I did 3 months down the Joy. Right. It was like being in a holiday camp.
Mm-hmm. Mine was for not paying bills.
Right. And they put you in for not paying bills?
Not paying TV licence. A lot of people do get out the same day. They're just put in and put back out.
But you see, I had been in trouble before, but it was only a stupid shoplifting thing for robbing rashes, 6 rashes or something, 8 rashes.
But I'm guessing in your case you had a drug habit.
I did indeed, yeah. I'm much better now. I'm clean. I'm clean. I'm off everything like about 2 years, so I'm doing great. I am. Much better.
And you said a holiday camp in there, you're only recently.
It's like a holiday camp. The doors are open, you can do what you want. Do you know what I mean? But the only thing is, what people force going in, what be afraid of, there's bullying going on. But that's only if you allow yourself to be bullied.
Is this like from other women?
Yeah. That are in there a while and think they're hard women and try and take things off. Yeah. But I suppose it happens in the big prison as well.
The lesbian thing going on, because there is. They will try it on.
Try it on and threaten you and... So, well, some of the women that do is take people in under the wing. What I'd have done was, people that came in that were scared, I'd have took them under my wing, and which was done for me as well.
From Paddy O'Gorman's report on Monday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. On Tuesday's show, to mark the opening of the annual BT Young Scientists exhibition at the RDS, sisters and former winners Aisling and Kira Judge joined Sean in studio when they discussed science and sibling rivalry.
We're a competitive family in general. So I suppose when she won, it didn't even enter my head that it would be difficult to win. I must have had a very low, a feeling about her that if she won, of course I can win if Aisling won. So I had my project from second class. I was going to cure all allergies to animals. Yeah, that didn't happen. But no problem. I was going to win. And then in fourth class, it kind of occurred to me. I was like, yeah, I'm never going to win this.
Did it cross your mind to ask her for any tips or advice?
No, because I do not take, I fully admit, and my parents and everybody says this to me, I do not take advice. So despite the fact that she is a winner of the Young Scientist, she could tell me, oh yeah, if you do this, you will actually win the whole Young Scientist and you'll win loads of money. And I'll be like, no, that's the wrong way of doing it. Nope. Asking her for advice would just be not a very smart move, because it would just end up in us fighting.
Cork girls and former winners of the Young Scientist exhibition, Kira and Aisling Judge, on Today with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Now, whatever it is about Cork, that county seems to have had more than its fair share of winners over the years, which has to be good news to Jennifer Barry, Moira Barrett and Ruth Cavan from Bandon, who met Ryan Tuberty when he visited the show for 2FM on Thursday.
We're doing which bird guano is most acidic.
What?
Which bird guano, it's like bird droppings. So we just heard people giving out about it corroding their car and stuff. So we decided, to tell them that it wasn't the acid in the guano in the end. So that's basically what our project was. And we tested 17 types of bird guano, and we collected it and everything.
Okay, how did you collect the bird shite, the droppings?
Well, we went to some local farms, and we went to Rumley's Open Farm in near Cork City. And I had to go into all the cages with like a spoon and a bottle and get the guano bird droppings and put it into the bottle and get out of the cage as quickly as I could.
I love this guano business. That's a new one on me. It's very polite. It sounds like something you might put with chips when you're having dinner.
Yeah, well, it's actually the more scientific name, apparently.
From the Tuberty Show on 2FM on Thursday. Staying with matters scientific, on Thursday's Morning Ireland, Claire Byrne spoke to Irish astrophysicist Dr. Joseph Roach about how he is one of 1,000 people signed up for the Mars One mission to create the first human colony on Mars by 2025. 200,000 people initially applied to the programme, and if it does go ahead, the successful participants will go to Mars but never return. Claire asked him why he finds this so appealing.
For me, it's just such an obvious thing. I mean, I grew up in Kildare on a small farm. I spend my nights looking up at the stars. And then over the years, I went to Trinity College in Dublin. I studied science. I took a stint in the States working for NASA, and then I came back to Trinity to do my PhD in astrophysics. And since then, since I finished my PhD, I've been working with the Science Gallery, trying to promote science and speak about science. And the idea of getting to go to Mars is something that I would have dreamed about through all those years. And now the fact that there's something there that I could apply for, it's just a no-brainer for me.
Well, being a man of science, you'll be able to create a great distinction between what's real and what's not real. Is this really going to happen, or is it just somebody who wants to make a television programme off the back of all of this?
Well, I think this group, the Mars One Foundation, they're a group that have to be taken seriously. And it does sound like almost a crazy idea, but I think any new idea in this area is going to seem ridiculous at first. And we're at the stage now where we have government funded space exploration initiatives that can't get people into space. We don't have the capabilities to bring people to a planet and then launch from that planet to bring them back. And that's why Mars One is different, because they're going to cut the cost of the return trip. And that's why it's a feasible mission.
And have you considered, if you become this candidate who travels to Mars, that you may not be coming back?
Oh, I definitely wouldn't be coming back. Unfortunately, it's not up for debate. We just don't have the technical capabilities to bring people back. So yes, that's one of the key things. As soon as I get there, I would have to live out the rest of my days there. Now, I guess one of the upsides or downsides is that because you'd be exposed to conditions that no human has experienced before, and there's not enough atmosphere on Mars to protect you from radiation, even with a spacesuit, my life expectancy would be drastically reduced. So,
And you're all right with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way I look at it is, even if I had a shorter life on Mars, for every day that I live on that planet, I would be taking a leap forward in terms of the scientific endeavours of humankind. And for me, it'd just be a dream come true.
And what do the family in Kildare think of all of this?
Well, the family are very supportive with everything I do. Actually, my poor parents, the first time they found out was at a public talk. So when I don't see them for a while, they come and find me. And I give a lot of talks for Science Gallery at Trinity College. And they surprised me by being in the audience because I hadn't seen them for a while. I don't think they realised I was discussing the ethics of space exploration and how I might go to Mars and not come back. So one of the first questions they asked me in the audience was, what will your parents say? And I had to say, well, here's Mom and Dad. They can answer that one for you.
Dr. Joseph Roach on Morning Ireland on Thursday. Even those of us who know little or nothing about space exploration will have heard of astronaut Chris Hadfield. He was in Dublin this week, and on Thursday's drive time, he spoke to Will Goodbody, who asked him if he would have any interest in getting on board the Mars One mission.
I would want to know about the spaceship. That's my primary concern. I'm a pilot and a test pilot. I grew up on a farm. Machinery is important. And the machine and the spaceship are what keep you alive, of course. So for Mars One and for all of the exploration missions, I think that everyone involved should focus on the vehicle, on this, on the technology, on the spaceship, on the intricate details, because you have to sweat the small stuff of all of those details in order to have any success in the overarching objectives of what you're doing. And if I got convinced that there was a spaceship that had a very high probability of success of getting to Mars, it would be an extremely tempting thing to do, because that was the dream I had as a 9-year-old boy, was to go to the moon or to go to Mars, to take all of that, the edge of our capability and my own personal training and capability, and to try and push it right to the very limit in order to understand and do new things. I would be extremely tempted, yes.
Even if there was no way back?
Well, if it's no way back, then of course who you travel with is very important. And I would want to have friends and family along, of course. So we'll see. But, you know, we're a long way still from traveling to Mars. The technology is a real limiter. I think the Mars One project has shown the vast amount of support that exists and the interest. People that are willing to sign up for a one-way voyage, it's an enormous, I don't know, a bellwether, a clear call of the level of interest all around the world in that type of exploration.
Chris Hadfield talking to Will Goodbody on Drive Time on Thursday. Eilish O'Carroll, the sister of Brendan, who's better known to fans of Mrs. Brown's Boys as Winnie, was a guest in studio with Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday. As well as talking about her life on stage and screen, she told Miriam about how her life changed forever when she fell in love with another woman.
Yes, I was in my early 40s and I met a woman and I fell in love with a woman. And my hidden sexuality, if that's the only way I can describe it, I was unaware that I had these tendencies, and I'm going to use words that are commonly used in society. I don't necessarily like them, but I was unaware that I had these tendencies. But anyway, I fell in love with the woman, and to cut a long story very short, it did spell the end of my marriage in time. And it also spelled, you know, the end of her marriage in time. It didn't happen overnight, but and eventually I left my husband, and I carried on the journey, this discovery journey about my sexuality, and we tried to make this relationship work. Sadly, it failed. So in time, we broke up, and I returned to Ireland again. I think at the time, probably to hide, if I'm terribly honest. And I came back to Ireland to hide, to run away from it, to run away from the truth. But you can't run away from the truth. It comes up and bites your bum one day, and there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to face it. So I did. And I got the help that I needed to embrace who I was, what I was, and be proud of it. It wasn't an easy journey. It never is an easy journey, but I'm very pleased I did it. I have a wonderful family who supported me. I have two sons who are extremely proud of me and love me and supported me. And that was a great help in order to be where I am today.
And you have a partner now, and you're both very happy living in Cork.
Yes, I have a partner of 10 years standing now, and we're very happy living in Cork.
Eilish O'Carroll talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on Wednesday.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Clonus Town Hall for this week's Easy Slim meeting. Right. Well done, Mrs. Kavanagh. Now, Dolores, hurry along now and don't bother taking off the earrings. They won't make any difference on the scales. All right? Good girl.
That was Pat Kinavan from Sunday night's Drama on One, Weighing In, which featured two women and their plight to get to grips with their weight and other excess emotional baggage.
There's more to life than dieting.
Well, I'm sorry to say it, Breda, but that's the kind of attitude that will have you back in your fat clothes before you know it.
I know. Sometimes I feel like I'm fighting a losing battle. I'm beginning to wonder if it's all worth all the effort.
Now, don't say that. Now, we'll get you onto a crash diet and kickstart the system again.
Oh, I hate those things. I've tried them all and only ended up putting on more weight.
The cabbage soup diet works best.
Oh, I did it. I nearly had to buy a portaloo to bring around with me.
Okay, the neutron, it's fabulous.
Did it. Marty said he wouldn't sit in the same room as me. He said me breath smelled like a donkey's.
The Master Cleanse. It's the absolute latest. Gwyneth Paltrow swears by it. It's just lemons and laxatives for 3 days.
I didn't actually buy the portaloo in the end. You're not listening to me, Val. I'm never going on one of those fad diets again. They don't work. I'm living proof.
Fine. Then we'll have to do another few extra miles this evening at high speed to make up for it.
Helen Norton and Eva McGinnity as heard in last week's drama on One, Weighing In, which is written by Ger Gallagher and directed by Gretty Slaven. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, Finbar Wright was Miriam O'Callaghan's guest in studio on Friday. If you're feeling in need of a bit of a kickstart to start your day, hopefully this will do it. I'm Fiona Kelly, this is Valare, so until next week, goodbye.
10 seconds on your cosy non ritorni mai più. Mi depingeva la mani la faccia di blu. Poi d'improvviso veniva dal vento rapita e cominciava a volare nel cielo infinito. Per l'alto del sole ed ancora più su, mentre il mondo pian piano spariva lontano laggiù. Una musica dolce suonava soltanto per me. Volare, oh, cantare, oh, nel blu dipinto di blu, felice di stare. Sogno così non ritorni mai più. Mi dimenticavo la mani, la faccia di blu. Poi improvviso venivo dal vento rapito e cominciavo a volare nel cielo infinito.